in other respects also to be prejudicial to health. Official medical inquiries proved afterwards that, on the contrary, the average death rate is exceedingly high in the Silk Districts, and amongst the female parts of the population is higher even than it is in the cotton districts of Lancashire. Footnote. On the whole, the working population, subject to the Factory Act, has greatly improved physically. All medical testimony agrees on this point, and personal observation at different times has convinced me of it. Nevertheless, and exclusive of the terrible death rate of children in the first years of their life, the official reports of Dr. Greenhow show the unfavourable health condition of the manufacturing districts as compared with agricultural districts of normal health. End of footnote. Despite the protests of the factory inspector renewed every 6 months, the mischief continues to this hour. Footnote. It is well known with what reluctance the English free traders gave up the protective duty on the silk manufacture. Instead of the protection against French importation, the absence of protection to English factory children now serves their turn. End of footnote. The Act of 1850 changed the 15 hours' time from 6 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. into the 12 hours from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. for young persons and women only. It did not, therefore, affect children, who could always be employed for half an hour before and 2.5 hours after this period, provided the whole of their labour did not exceed 6.5 hours. Whilst the bill was under discussion, the factory inspectors laid before Parliament statistics of the infamous abuses due to this anomaly. To no purpose. In the background lurked the intention of screwing up, during prosperous years, the working day of adult males to 15 hours by the aid of children. The experience of the 3 following years showed that such an attempt must come to grief against the resistance of the adult male operatives. The Act of 1850 was therefore finally completed in 1853 by forbidding the employment of children in the morning before and in the evening after young persons and women. Henceforth, with a few exceptions, the Factory Act of 1850 regulated the working day of all workers in the branches of industry that come under it. Footnote. During 1859 and 1860, the zenith years of the English cotton industry, some manufacturers tried, by the decoy bait of higher wages for overtime, to reconcile the adult male operatives to an extension of the working day. The hand mule spinners and self-actor mincers put an end to the experiment by a petition to their employers in which they say, "Plainly speaking, our lives are to us a burthen, and while we are confined to the mills nearly 2 days a week more than the other operatives of the country, we feel like helots in the land, and that we are perpetuating a system injurious to ourselves and future generations. This, therefore, is to give you most respectful notice that when we commence work again after the Christmas and New Year's holidays, we shall work 60 hours per week, and no more, or from 6 to 6, with 1.5 hours out." End of footnote. Since the passing of the first Factory Act, half a century had elapsed. Factory legislation for the first time went beyond its original sphere in the Printworks Act of 1845. The displeasure with which capital received this new extravagance speaks through every line of the Act. It limits the working day for children from 8 to 13 and for women to 16 hours between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. without any legal pause for meal times. It allows males over 13 to be worked at will, day and night. Footnote. Quote, "Children of the age of 8 years and upwards have indeed been employed from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., during the last half year in my district. Unquote. End of footnote. It is a parliamentary abortion. Footnote. Quote, the Printworks Act is admitted to be a failure, both with reference to its educational and protective provisions. Unquote. 1862. End of footnote. However, the principle had triumphed with its victory in those great branches of industry which form the most characteristic creation of the modern mode of production. Their wonderful development from 1853 to 1860, hand in hand with the physical and moral regeneration of the factory workers, struck the most purblind. The masters, from whom the legal limitation and regulation had been wrung step by step after a civil war of half a century, themselves referred ostentatiously to the contrast with the branches of exploitation still free. Footnote. Thus, for example, E. Potter in a letter to the Times of March the 24th, 1863. The Times reminded him of the manufacturers' revolt against the 10 hours bill. End of footnote. The Pharisees of political economy now proclaimed the discernment of the necessity of a legally fixed working day as a characteristic new discovery of their science. Footnote. Thus, among others, Mr. W. Newmarch, collaborator and editor of Tooke's History of Prices. Is it a scientific advance to make cowardly concessions to public opinion? End of footnote. It will be easily understood that after the factory magnates had resigned themselves and become reconciled to the inevitable, the power of resistance of capital gradually weakened, whilst at the same time the power of attack of the working class grew with the number of its allies in the classes of society not immediately interested in the question. Hence the comparatively rapid advance since 1860. The dye-works and bleach-works all came under the Factory Act of 1850 in 1860, lace and stocking manufactures in 1861. Footnote. The Act passed in 1860 determined that, in regard to dye and bleach works, the working day should be fixed on August 1, 1861, provisionally at 12 hours, and definitely on August 1, 1862, at 10 hours, that is, at 10.5 hours for ordinary days and 7.5 for Saturday. Now, when the fatal year 1862 came, the old farce was repeated. Besides, the manufacturers petitioned Parliament to allow the employment of young persons and women for 12 hours during 1 year longer, in the existing condition of the trade, the time of the cotton famine. It was greatly to the advantage of the operatives to work 12 hours per day and make wages when they could. A bill to this effect had been brought in, and it was mainly due to the action of the operative bleachers in Scotland that the bill was abandoned. Thus defeated by the very workpeople in whose name it pretended to speak, capital discovered, with the help of lawyer spectacles, that the Act of 1860, drawn up, like all the Acts of Parliament for the protection of labour, in equivocal phrases, gave them a pretext to exclude from its working the calendarers and finishers. English jurisprudence, ever the faithful servant of capital, sanctioned in the Court of Common Pleas this piece of pettifogging. The operatives have been greatly disappointed. They have complained of overwork, and it is greatly to be regretted that the clear intention of the legislature should have failed by reason of a faulty definition. End of footnote. In consequence of the first report of the Commission on the Employment of Children, 1863, the same fate was shared by the manufacturers of all earthenwares, not merely pottery, lucifer matches, percussion caps, cartridges, carpets, fustian cutting, and many processes included under the name of finishing. In the year 1863, bleaching in the open air and baking were placed under special acts, by which, in the former, the labour of young persons and women during the night time, from 8 in the evening to 6 in the morning, and in the latter, the employment of journeymen bakers under 18 between 9 in the evening and 5 in the morning, were forbidden. Footnote. The open-air bleachers had evaded the law of 1860 by means of the lie that no women worked at it in the night. The lie was exposed by the factory inspectors, and at the same time Parliament was, by petitions from the operatives, bereft of its notions as to the cool meadow fragrance in which bleaching in the open air was reported to take place. In this aerial bleaching, drying rooms were used at temperatures of from 90 degrees to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, in which the work was done for the most part by girls. Cooling is the technical expression for their occasional escape from the drying rooms into the fresh air. 15 girls in stoves, heat from 80 degrees to 90 degrees for linens and 100 degrees and upwards for cambrics. 12 girls ironing and doing up in a small room about 10 feet square, in the centre of which is a close stove. The girls stand round the stove, which throws out a terrific heat, and dries the cambrics rapidly for the ironers. The hours of work for these hands are unlimited. If busy, they work till 9 or 12 at night for successive nights. Reports, etc., for 31st of October 1862. A medical man states, no special hours are allowed for cooling, but if the temperature gets too high or the workers' hands get soiled from perspiration, they are allowed to go out for a few minutes. My experience, which is considerable, in treating the diseases of stove workers, compels me to express the opinion that their sanitary condition is by no means so high as that of the operatives in a spinning factory. And Capital, in its memorials to Parliament, had painted them as floridly healthy after the manner of Rubens. The diseases mostly observable among them are phthisis, bronchitis, irregularity of uterine functions, hysteria in its most aggravated forms, and rheumatism. All of these, I believe, are either directly or indirectly induced by the impure, overheated air of the apartments in which the hands are employed, and the want of sufficient comfortable clothing to protect them from the cold, damp atmosphere in winter when going to their homes. The factory inspectors remarked on the supplementary law of 1860, torn from these open-air bleachers. The Act has not only failed to afford that protection to the workers which it appears to offer, but contains a clause apparently so worded that unless persons are detected working after 8 o'clock at night, they appear to come under no protective provisions at all, and if they do so work, the mode of proof is so doubtful that a conviction can scarcely follow. To all intents and purposes, therefore, as an act for any benevolent or educational purpose, it is a failure, since it can scarcely be called benevolent to permit, which is tantamount to compelling, women and children to work 14 hours a day with or without meals, as the case may be, and perhaps for longer hours than these, without limit as to age, without reference to sex, and without regard to the social habits of the families of the neighbourhood, in which such works, bleaching and dyeing, are situated. End of footnote. We shall return to the later proposals of the same commission, which threatened to deprive of their freedom all the important branches of English industry, with the exception of agriculture, mines, and the means of transport. Footnote. Note to the second edition. Since 1866, when I wrote the above passages, a reaction has again set in. End of footnote. Section 7. The Struggle for a Normal Working Day. Reaction of the English Factory Acts on Other Countries. The reader will bear in mind that the production of surplus value, or the extraction of surplus labour, is the specific end and aim, the sum and substance, of capitalist production, quite apart from any changes in the mode of production which may arise from the subordination of labour to capital. He will remember that as far as we have at present gone, only the independent labourer, and therefore only the labourer legally qualified to act for himself, enters as a vendor of a commodity into a contract with the capitalist. If, therefore, in our historical sketch, on the one hand, modern industry, on the other, the labour of those who are physically and legally minors, play important parts, the former was to us only a special department, and the latter only a specially striking example of labour exploitation. Without, however, anticipating the subsequent development of our inquiry, from the mere connection of the historic facts before us, it follows, first, the passion of capital for an unlimited and reckless extension of the working day is first gratified in the industries earliest revolutionized by water power, steam, and machinery, in those first creations of the modern mode of production, cotton, wool, flax, and silk spinning and weaving. The changes in the material mode of production and the corresponding changes in the social relations of the producers gave rise first to an extravagance beyond all bounds, and then, in opposition to this, called forth a control on the part of society which legally limits, regulates, and makes uniform the working day and its pauses. This control appears, therefore, during the first half of the 19th century, simply as exceptional legislation. Footnote. The employments placed under restriction were connected with the manufacture of textile fabrics by the aid of steam or water power. There were two conditions to which an employment must be subject to cause it to be inspected, viz. The use of steam or water power and the manufacture of certain specified fibre. End of footnote. As soon as this primitive dominion of the new mode of production was conquered, it was found that in the meantime not only had many other branches of production been made to adopt the same factory system, but that manufactures with more or less obsolete methods, such as potteries, glass-making, etc., that old-fashioned handicrafts like baking, and finally even that the so-called domestic industries, such as nail-making, had long since fallen as completely under capitalist exploitation as the factories themselves. Footnote. On the condition of so-called domestic industries, specially valuable materials are to be found in the latest reports of the Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. Legislation was, therefore, compelled to gradually get rid of its exceptional character, or, where, as in England, it proceeds after the manner of the Roman casuists, to declare any house in which work was done to be a factory. Footnote. The Acts of last session, 1864, embrace a diversity of occupations, the customs in which differ greatly, and the use of mechanical power to give motion to machinery is no longer one of the elements necessary, as formerly, to constitute, in legal phrase, a factory. End of footnote. Second, the history of the regulation of the working day in certain branches of production, and the struggle still going on in others in regard to this regulation, prove conclusively that the isolated labourer, the labourer as free vendor of his labour power, when capitalist production has once attained a certain stage, succumbs without any power of resistance. The creation of a normal working day is, therefore, the product of a protracted civil war, more or less dissembled, between the capitalist class and the working class. As the contest takes place in the arena of modern industry, it first breaks out in the home of that industry, England. Footnote. Belgium, the paradise of continental liberalism, shows no trace of this movement. Even in the coal and metal mines, labourers of both sexes and all ages are consumed in perfect freedom at any period and through any length of time. Of every 1,000 persons employed there, 733 are men, 88 women, 135 boys, and 44 girls under 16. In the blast furnaces, etc., of every 1,000, 668 are men, 149 women, 98 boys, and 85 girls under 16. Add to this the low wages for the enormous exploitation of mature and immature labour power. The average daily pay for a man is 2 shillings and 8 pence. For a woman, 1 shilling and 8 pence. For a boy, 1 shilling and 2 pence halfpenny. As a result, Belgium had, in 1863, as compared with 1850, nearly doubled both the amount and value of its exports of coal, iron, etc. End of footnote. The English factory workers were the champions not only of the English, but of the modern working class generally, as their theorists were the first to throw down the gauntlet to the theory of capital. Footnote. Robert Owen, soon after 1810, not only maintained the necessity of a limitation of the working day in theory, but actually introduced the 10 hours day into his factory at New Lanark. This was laughed at as a communist utopia. So were his combination of children's education with productive labour and the cooperative societies of working men, first called into being by him. Today, the first utopia is a factory act. The second figures as an official phrase in all factory acts. The third is already being used as a cloak for reactionary humbug. End of footnote. Hence, the philosopher of the factory, Ure, denounces as an ineffable disgrace to the English working class that they inscribed the slavery of the factory acts on the banner which they bore against capital, manfully striving for perfect freedom of labour. Footnote. Ure, French translation, Philosophie des Manufactures, Paris, 1836, end of footnote. France limps slowly behind England. The February Revolution was necessary to bring into the world the 12 hours law, which is much more deficient than its English original. Footnote. In the Compte Rendu of the International Statistical Congress at Paris, 1855, it is stated, "The French law, which limits the length of daily labour in factories and workshops to 12 hours, does not confine this work to definite fixed hours. For children's labour only, the work time is prescribed as between 5 a.m. and 9 p.m. Therefore, some of the masters use the right which this fatal silence gives them to keep their works going without intermission day in, day out, possibly with the exception of Sunday. For this purpose they use 2 different sets of workers, of whom neither is in the workshop more than 12 hours at a time, but the work of the establishment lasts day and night. The law is satisfied, but is humanity? Besides the destructive influence of night labour on the human organism, stress is also laid upon the fatal influence of the association of the 2 sexes by night in the same badly lighted workshops." End of footnote. For all that, the French revolutionary method has its special advantages. It once for all commands the same limit to the working day in all shops and factories without distinction, whilst English legislation reluctantly yields to the pressure of circumstances, now on this point, now on that, and is getting lost in a hopelessly bewildering tangle of contradictory enactments. Footnote. For instance, there is within my district one occupier who, within the same curtilage, is at the same time a bleacher and dyer under the Bleaching and Dyeing Works Act, a printer under the Print Works Act, and a finisher under the Factory Act. Report of Mr. Baker in Reports for October the 31st, 1861. After enumerating the different provisions of these acts and the complications arising from them, Mr. Baker says, It will hence appear that it must be very difficult to secure the execution of these three Acts of Parliament where the occupier chooses to evade the law. But what is assured to the lawyers by this is lawsuits. End of footnote. On the other hand, the French law proclaims as a principle that which in England was only won in the name of children, minors, and women, and has been only recently, for the first time, claimed as a general right. Footnote. Thus, the factory inspectors at last venture to say, these objections, of capital to the legal limitations of the working day, must succumb before the broad principle of the rights of labour. There is a time when the master's right in his workman's labour ceases, and his time becomes his own, even if there were no exhaustion in the question. End of footnote. In the United States of North America, every independent movement of the workers was paralysed, so long as slavery disfigured a part of the republic. Labour cannot emancipate itself in the white skin, where in the black it is branded. But out of the death of slavery a new life at once arose. The first fruit of the Civil War was the 8 hours' agitation that ran with the seven-leagued boots of the locomotive from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from New England to California. The General Congress of Labour at Baltimore, August 16, 1866, declared, "The first and great necessity of the present, to free the labour of this country from capitalistic slavery, is the passing of a law by which 8 hours shall be the normal working day in all states of the American Union. We are resolved to put forth all our strength until this glorious result is attained." Footnote. We, the workers of Dunkirk, declare that the length of time of labour required under the present system is too great, and that, far from leaving the worker time for rest and education, it plunges him into a condition of servitude but little better than slavery. That is why we decide that 8 hours are enough for a working day, and ought to be legally recognised as enough. Why we call to our help that powerful lever, the press, and why we shall consider all those that refuse us this help as enemies of the reform of labour and of the rights of the labourer. Resolution of the Working Men of Dunkirk, New York State, 1866. End of footnote. At the same time, the Congress of the International Working Men's Association at Geneva, on the proposition of the London General Council, resolve that the limitation of the working day is a preliminary condition, without which all further attempts at improvement and emancipation must prove abortive. The Congress proposes 8 hours as the legal limit of the working day. Thus the movement of the working class on both sides of the Atlantic, that had grown instinctively out of the conditions of production themselves, endorsed the words of the English factory inspector, R.J. Saunders. Further steps towards a reformation of society can never be carried out with any hope of success unless the hours of labour be limited and the prescribed limit strictly enforced. It must be acknowledged that our labourer comes out of the process of production other than he entered. In the market, he stood as owner of the commodity labour power, face to face with other owners of commodities, dealer against dealer. The contract by which he sold to the capitalist his labour power proved, so to say, in black and white, that he disposed of himself freely. The bargain concluded, it is discovered that he was no free agent. Footnote. The proceedings, the manoeuvres of capital, for example, from 1848 to 50, have afforded, moreover, incontrovertible proof of the fallacy of the assertion so often advanced, that operatives need no protection, but may be considered as free agents in the disposal of the only property which they possess, the labour of their hands and the sweat of their brows. Free labour, if so it may be termed, even in a free country, requires the strong arm of the law to protect it. To permit, which is tantamount to compelling, to work 14 hours a day with or without meals, etc. End of footnote. The time for which he is free to sell his labour power is the time for which he is forced to sell it, that in fact the vampire will not lose its hold on him so long as there is a muscle, a nerve, a drop of blood to be exploited. Footnote. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. For protection against the serpent of their agonies, the labourers must put their heads together and, as a class, compel the passing of a law, an all-powerful social barrier, that shall prevent the very workers from selling, by voluntary contract with capital, themselves and their families into slavery and death. Footnote. The 10 Hours Act has, in the branches of industry that come under it, put an end to the premature decrepitude of the former long-hour workers. Capital, in factories, can never be employed in keeping the machinery in motion beyond a limited time without certain injury to the health and morals of the labourers employed, and they are not in a position to protect themselves. End of footnote. In place of the pompous catalogue of the inalienable rights of man comes the modest Magna Carta of a legally limited working day, which shall make clear when the time which the worker sells is ended, and when his own begins. Quantum mutatus ab illo. What a great change from that time. Virgil. Footnote. A still greater boon is the distinction at last made clear between the worker's own time and his master's. The worker knows now when that which he sells is ended, and when his own begins, and by possessing a sure foreknowledge of this, is enabled to prearrange his own minutes for his own purposes. By making them masters of their own time, the Factory Acts have given them a moral energy which is directing them to the eventual possession of political power. With suppressed irony, and in very well weighed words, the factory inspectors hint that the actual law also frees the capitalist from some of the brutality natural to a man who is a mere embodiment of capital, and that it has given him time for a little culture. Formerly the master had no time for anything but money. The servant had no time for anything but labour. Chapter 11. Rate and Mass of Surplus Value. In this chapter, as hitherto, the value of labour power, and therefore the part of the working day necessary for the reproduction or maintenance of that labour power, are supposed to be given constant magnitudes. This premised, with the rate, the mass is at the same time given of the surplus value that the individual labourer furnishes to the capitalist in a definite period of time. If, for example, the necessary labour amounts to 6 hours daily, expressed in a quantum of gold equals 3 shillings, then 3 shillings is the daily value of one labour power, or the value of the capital advanced in the buying of one labour power. If, further, the rate of surplus value be equal to 100%, this variable capital of 3 shillings produces a mass of surplus value of 3 shillings. Or the labourer supplies daily a mass of surplus labour equal to 6 hours. But the variable capital of a capitalist is the expression in money of the total value of all the labour powers that he employs simultaneously. Its value is, therefore, equal to the average value of one labour power multiplied by the number of labour powers employed. With a given value of labour power, therefore, the magnitude of the variable capital varies directly as the number of labourers employed simultaneously. If the daily value of one labour power equals 3 shillings, then a capital of 300 shillings must be advanced in order to exploit daily 100 labour powers. Of n times 3 shillings, in order to exploit daily n labour powers. In the same way, if a variable capital of 3 shillings, being the daily value of 1 labour power, produce a daily surplus value of 3 shillings, a variable capital of 300 shillings will produce a daily surplus value of 300 shillings, and one of n times 3 shillings, a daily surplus value of n times 3 shillings. The mass of the surplus value produced is therefore equal to the surplus value which the working day of 1 labourer supplies, multiplied by the number of labourers employed. But as the mass of surplus value which a single labourer produces, the value of labour power being given, is determined by the rate of the surplus value, this law follows. The mass of the surplus value produced is equal to the amount of the variable capital advanced, multiplied by the rate of surplus value. In other words, it is determined by the compound ratio between the number of labour powers exploited simultaneously by the same capitalist and the degree of exploitation of each individual labour power. Let the mass of the surplus value be uppercase S. The surplus value supplied by the individual labourer in the average day, lowercase s. The variable capital daily advanced in the purchase of 1 individual labour power, lowercase v. The sum total of the variable capital, uppercase v. The value of an average labour power, p. Its degree of exploitation, surplus labour over necessary labour, and the number of labourers employed, n. We would have uppercase S equals lowercase s over lowercase v times uppercase v equals p times surplus labour over necessary labour times n. It is always supposed not only that the value of an average labour power is constant, but that the labourers employed by a capitalist are reduced to average labourers. There are exceptional cases in which the surplus value produced does not increase in proportion to the number of labourers exploited, but then the value of the labour power does not remain constant. In the production of a definite mass of surplus value, therefore, the decrease of one factor may be compensated by the increase of the other. If the variable capital diminishes, and at the same time the rate of surplus value increases in the same ratio, the mass of surplus value produced remains unaltered. If, on our earlier assumption, the capitalist must advance 300 shillings in order to exploit 100 labourers a day, and if the rate of surplus value amounts to 50%, this variable capital of 300 shillings yields a surplus value of 150 shillings, or of 100 times 3 working hours. If the rate of surplus value doubles, or the working day, instead of being extended from 6 to 9, is extended from 6 to 12 hours, and at the same time variable capital is lessened by half and reduced to 150 shillings, it yields also a surplus value of 150 shillings, or 50 times 6 working hours. Diminution of the variable capital may therefore be compensated by a proportionate rise in the degree of exploitation of labour power, or the decrease in the number of labourers employed by a proportionate extension of the working day. Within certain limits, therefore, the supply of labour exploitable by capital is independent of the supply of labourers. Footnote. This elementary law appears to be unknown to the vulgar economists who, upside-down Archimedes, in the determination of the marketplace of labour by supply and demand, imagine they have found the fulcrum by means of which not to move the world, but to stop its motion. End of footnote. On the contrary, a fall in the rate of surplus value leaves unaltered the mass of the surplus value produced if the amount of the variable capital, or number of the laborers employed, increases in the same proportion. Nevertheless, the compensation of a decrease in the number of laborers employed or of the amount of variable capital advanced by a rise in the rate of surplus value or by the lengthening of the working day has impassable limits. Whatever the value of labor power may be, whether the working time necessary for the maintenance of the laborer is 2 or 10 hours, the total value that a laborer can produce day in, day out, is always less than the value in which 24 hours of labour are embodied, less than 12 shillings, if 12 shillings is the money expression for 24 hours of realised labour. In our former assumption, according to which 6 working hours are daily necessary in order to reproduce the labour power itself, or to replace the value of the capital advanced in its purchase, a variable capital of 1,500 shillings that employs 500 labourers at a rate of surplus value of 100% with a 12 hours working day produces daily a surplus value of 1,500 shillings, or of 6 times 500 working hours. A capital of 300 shillings that employs 100 labourers a day with a rate of surplus value of 200%, or with a working day of 18 hours, produces only a mass of surplus value of 600 shillings, or 12 times 100 working hours, and its total value product, the equivalent of the variable capital advanced, plus the surplus value, can, day in, day out, never reach the sum of 1,200 shillings, or 24 times 100 working hours. The absolute limit of the average working day, this being by nature always less than 24 hours, sets an absolute limit to the compensation of a reduction of variable capital by a higher rate of surplus value, or of the decrease of the number of labourers exploited by a higher degree of exploitation of labour power. This palpable law is of importance for the clearing up of many phenomena arising from a tendency, to be worked out later on, of capital to reduce as much as possible the number of labourers employed by it, or its variable constituent transformed into labour power, in contradiction to its other tendency to produce the greatest possible mass of surplus value. On the other hand, if the mass of labour power employed, or the amount of variable capital, increases, but not in proportion to the fall in the rate of surplus value, the mass of the surplus value produced falls. A third law results from the determination of the mass of the surplus value produced by the two factors, rate of surplus value and amount of variable capital advanced. The rate of surplus value, or the degree of exploitation of labour power, and the value of labour power, or the amount of necessary working time, being given, it is self-evident that the greater the variable capital, the greater would be the mass of the value produced and of the surplus value. If the limit of the working day is given, and also the limit of its necessary constituent, the mass of value and surplus value that an individual capitalist produces is clearly exclusively dependent on the mass of labour that he sets in motion. But this, under the conditions supposed, depends on the mass of labour power, or the number of labourers whom he exploits, and this number in its turn is determined by the amount of the variable capital advanced. With a given rate of surplus value, and a given value of labour power, therefore, the masses of surplus value produced vary directly as the amounts of the variable capitals advanced. Now we know that the capitalist divides his capital into two parts. One part he lays out in means of production. This is the constant part of his capital. The other part he lays out in living labour power. This part forms his variable capital. On the basis of the same mode of social production, The division of capital into constant and variable differs in different branches of production, and within the same branch of production too, this relation changes with changes in the technical conditions and in the social combinations of the processes of production. But in whatever proportion a given capital breaks up into a constant and a variable part, whether the latter is to the former as 1:2, or 1:10, or 1:x, the law just laid down is not affected by this. For, according to our previous analysis, the value of the constant capital reappears in the value of the product, but does not enter into the newly produced value, the newly created value product. To employ 1,000 spinners, more raw material, spindles, etc. are, of course, required than to employ 100. The value of these additional means of production, however, may rise, fall, remain unaltered, be large or small. It has no influence on the process of creation of surplus value by means of the labour powers that put them in motion. The law demonstrated just now, therefore, takes this form. The masses of value and of surplus value produced by different capitals, the value of labour power being given and its degree of exploitation being equal, vary directly as the amounts of variable constituents of these capitals, that is, as their constituents transformed into living labour power. This law clearly contradicts all experience based on appearance. Everyone knows that a cotton spinner, who, reckoning the percentage on the whole of his applied capital, employs much constant and little variable capital, does not, on account of this, pocket less profit or surplus value than a baker, who relatively sets in motion much variable and little constant capital. For the solution of this apparent contradiction, many intermediate terms are as yet wanted, as from the standpoint of elementary algebra, many intermediate terms are wanted to understand that 0/0 may represent an actual magnitude. Classical economy, although not formulating the law, holds instinctively to it, because it is a necessary consequence of the general law of value. It tries to rescue the law from collision with contradictory phenomena by a violent abstraction. Footnote. Further particulars will be given in Book 4. End of footnote. It will be seen later how the school of Ricardo has come to grief over this stumbling block. Vulgar economy, which, indeed, has really learnt nothing, here as everywhere sticks to appearances in opposition to the law which regulates and explains them. In opposition to Spinoza, it believes that ignorance is a sufficient reason. The labour which is set in motion by the total capital of a society, day in, day out, may be regarded as a single collective working day. If, for example, the number of labourers is 1,000,000, and the average working day of a labourer is 10 hours, the social working day consists of 10,000,000 hours. With a given length of this working day, whether its limits are fixed physically or socially, the mass of surplus value can only be increased by increasing the number of labourers, that is, of the labouring population. The growth of population here forms the mathematical limit to the production of surplus value by the total social capital. On the contrary, with a given amount of population, this limit is formed by the possible lengthening of the working day. Footnote. The labour, that is the economic time of society, is a given portion, say, 10 hours a day, of 1,000,000 people, or 10,000,000 hours. Capital has its boundary of increase. This boundary may, at any given period, be attained in the actual extent of economic time employed. An Essay on the Political Economy of Nations, London, 1821. End of footnote. It will, however, be seen in the following chapter that this law only holds for the form of surplus value dealt with up to the present. From the treatment of the production of surplus value so far, it follows that not every sum of money, or of value, is at pleasure transformable into capital. To effect this transformation, in fact, a certain minimum of money or of exchange value must be presupposed in the hands of the individual possessor of money or commodities. The minimum of variable capital is the cost price of a single labour power, employed the whole year through, day in, day out, for the production of surplus value. If this labourer were in possession of his own means of production and were satisfied to live as a labourer, he would not work beyond the time necessary for the reproduction of his means of subsistence, say, 8 hours a day. He would, besides, only require the means of production sufficient for 8 working hours. The capitalist, on the other hand, who makes him do, besides these 8 hours, say 4 hours surplus labour, requires an additional sum of money for furnishing the additional means of production. On our supposition, however, he would have to employ 2 labourers in order to live on the surplus value appropriated daily, as well as, and no better than a labourer, that is, to be able to satisfy his necessary wants. In this case, the mere maintenance of life would be the end of his production, not the increase of wealth. But this latter is implied in capitalist production. That he may live only twice as well as an ordinary labourer, and besides turn half of the surplus value produced into capital, he would have to raise, with the number of labourers, the minimum of the capital advanced 8 times. Of course he can, like his labourer, take to work himself, participate directly in the process of production, but he is then only a hybrid between capitalist and labourer, a small master. A certain stage of capitalist production necessitates that the capitalist be able to devote the whole of the time during which he functions as a capitalist, that is, as personified capital, to the appropriation and therefore control of the labour of others, and to the selling of the products of this labour. Footnote. The farmer cannot rely on his own labour, and if he does, I will maintain that he is a loser by it. His employment should be a general attention to the whole. His thresher must be watched, or he will soon lose his wages in corn not threshed out. His mowers, reapers, etc. must be looked after. He must constantly go round his fences. He must see there is no neglect, which would be the case if he was confined to any one spot. An inquiry into the connection between the present price of provisions and the size of farms, etc., by a farmer, London, 1773. This book is very interesting. In it, the genesis of the capitalist farmer, or merchant farmer, as he is explicitly called, may be studied, and his self-glorification at the expense of the small farmer, who has only to do with bare subsistence, be noted. The class of capitalists are from the first partially, and they become ultimately completely, discharged from the necessity of the manual labour. Textbook of Lectures on the Political Economy of Nations, by the Reverend Richard Jones, Hartford, 1852. End of footnote. The guilds of the Middle Ages therefore tried to prevent by force the transformation of the master of a trade into a capitalist, by limiting the number of labourers that could be employed by one master within a very small maximum. The possessor of money or commodities actually turns into a capitalist in such cases only where the minimum sum advanced for production greatly exceeds the maximum of the Middle Ages. Here, as in natural science, is shown the correctness of the law discovered by Hegel in his Logic, that merely quantitative differences, beyond a certain point, pass into qualitative changes. Footnote. The molecular theory of modern chemistry, first scientifically worked out by Laurent and Gerhardt, rests on no other law. addition to third edition. For the explanation of this statement, which is not very clear to non-chemists, we remark that the author speaks here of the homologous series of carbon compounds, first so named by C. Gerhardt in 1843, each series of which has its own general algebraic formula. Thus, the series of paraffins, CnH2n plus 2, that of the normal alcohols, CnH2n plus 2O, of the normal fatty acids, CnH2nO2, and many others. In the above examples, by the simply quantitative addition of CH2 to the molecular formula, a qualitatively different body is each time formed. On the share, overestimated by Marx, of Laurent and Gerhardt in the determination of this important fact, see Kopp, Entwicklung der Chemie, 1873, and Schokme, The Rise and Development of Organic Chemistry, 1879. Friedrich Engels. See Letter from Marx to Engels, 22nd of June, 1867. End of footnote. The minimum of the sum of value that the individual possessor of money or commodities must command in order to metamorphose himself into a capitalist changes with the different stages of development of capitalist production, and is at given stages different in different spheres of production, according to their special and technical conditions. Certain spheres of production demand, even at the very outset of capitalist production, a minimum of capital that is not as yet found in the hands of single individuals. This gives rise partly to state subsidies to private persons, as in France in the time of Clobert, and as in many German states up to our own epoch, partly to the formation of societies with legal monopoly for the exploitation of certain branches of industry and commerce, the forerunners of our modern joint stock companies. Footnote. Martin Luther calls these kinds of institutions the company monopolia. End of footnote. Within the process of production, as we have seen, capital acquired the command over labour, that is, over functioning labour power or the labourer himself. Personified capital, the capitalist, takes care that the labourer does his work regularly and with the proper degree of intensity. Capital further developed into a coercive relation, which compels the working class to do more work than the narrow round of its own life wants prescribes. As a producer of the activity of others, as a pumper out of surplus labour and exploiter of labour power, it surpasses in energy, disregard of bounds, recklessness and efficiency, all earlier systems of production based on directly compulsory labour. At first, capital subordinates labour on the basis of the technical conditions in which it historically finds it. It does not, therefore, change immediately the mode of production. The production of surplus value, in the form hitherto considered by us, by means of simple extension of the working day, proved, therefore, to be independent of any change in the mode of production itself. It was not less active in the old-fashioned bakeries than in the modern cotton factories. If we consider the process of production from the point of view of the simple labour process, the labourer stands in relation to the means of production not in their quality as capital, but as the mere means and material of his own intelligent productive activity. In tanning, for example, he deals with the skins as his simple object of labour. It is not the capitalist whose skin he tans. But it is different as soon as we deal with the process of production from the point of view of the process of creation of surplus value. The means of production are at once changed into means for the absorption of the labour of others. It is now no longer the labourer that employs the means of production, but the means of production that employ the labourer. Instead of being consumed by him as material elements of his productive activity, they consume him as the ferment necessary to their own life process, and the life process of capital consists only in its movement as value constantly expanding, constantly multiplying itself. Furnaces and workshops that stand idle by night and absorb no living labour are a mere loss to the capitalist. Hence, furnaces and workshops constitute lawful claims upon the night labour of the workpeople. The simple transformation of money into the material factors of the process of production into means of production transforms the latter into a title and a right to the labour and surplus labour of others. An example will show in conclusion how this sophistication, peculiar to and characteristic of capitalist production, this complete inversion of the relation between dead and living labour, between value and the force that creates value, mirrors itself in the consciousness of capitalists. During the revolt of the English factory lords between 1848 and 1850, the head of one of the oldest and most respectable houses in the west of Scotland, Messrs. Carlyle Sons and Company of the linen and cotton thread factory at Paisley, a company which has now existed for about a century, which was in operation in 1752, and four generations of the same family have conducted it, this very intelligent gentleman then wrote a letter in the Glasgow Daily Mail of April the 25th, 1849, with the title The Relay System, in which, among other things, the following grotesquely naive passage occurs. "Let us now see what evils will attend the limiting to 10 hours the working of the factory. They amount to the most serious damage to the mill-owner's prospects and property. If he, that is, his hands, worked 12 hours before and is limited to 10, then every 12 machines or spindles in his establishment shrink to 10, and should the works be disposed of, they will be valued only as 10, so that a sixth part would thus be deducted from the value of every factory in the country." Footnote. Factory Inspector Stewart, himself a Scotchman, and in contrast to the English factory inspectors quite taken captive by the capitalistic method of thinking, remarks expressly on this letter, which he incorporates in his report, that it is the most useful of the communications which any of the factory owners working with relays have given to those engaged in the same trade, and which is the most calculated to remove the prejudices of such of them as have scruples respecting any change of the arrangement of the hours of work. End of footnote. To this West of Scotland bourgeois brain, inheriting the accumulated capitalistic qualities of four generations, the value of the means of production, spindles, etc., is so inseparably mixed up with their property, as capital, to expand their own value and to swallow up daily a definite quantity of the unpaid labour of others, that the head of the firm of Carlyle and Company actually imagines that if he sells his factory, not only will the value of the spindles be paid to him, but in addition, their power of annexing surplus value, not only the labour which is embodied in them and is necessary to the production of spindles of this kind, but also the surplus labour which they help to pump out daily from the brave Scots of Paisley. And for that very reason, he thinks that with the shortening of the working day by 2 hours, the selling price of 12 spinning machines dwindles to that of 10. Part 4. Production of Relative Surplus Value. Chapter 12. The Concept of Relative Surplus Value. That portion of the working day which merely produces an equivalent for the value paid by the capitalist for his labour power has, up to this point, been treated by us as a constant magnitude. And such, in fact, it is, under given conditions of production and at a given stage in the economic development of society. Beyond this, his necessary labour time, the labourer, we saw, could continue to work for 2, 3, 4, 6, etc. hours. The rate of surplus value and the length of the working day depended on the magnitude of this prolongation. Though the necessary labour time was constant, we saw, on the other hand, that the total working day was variable. Now suppose we have a working day whose length and whose apportionment between necessary labour and surplus labour are given. Let the whole line AC, A, B, C, represent, for example, a working day of 12 hours. The portion of AB, 10 hours of necessary labour, and the portion BC, 2 hours of surplus labour. How now can the production of surplus value be increased? That is, how can the surplus labour be prolonged without or independently of any prolongation of AC? Although the length of AC is given, BC appears to be capable of prolongation, if not by extension beyond its end C, which is also at the end of the working day AC, yet at all events by pushing back its starting point B in the direction of A. Assume that D to B in the line ADBC is equal to half of BC, or to 1 hour's labour time. If now, in AC, the working day of 12 hours, we move the point B to D, BC becomes DC. The surplus labour increases by one half, from 2 hours to 3 hours, although the working day remains as before at 12 hours. This extension of the surplus labour time from BC to DC, from 2 hours to 3 hours, is, however, evidently impossible without a simultaneous contraction of the necessary labour time from AB into AD, from 10 hours to 9 hours. The prolongation of the surplus labour would correspond to a shortening of the necessary labour, or a portion of the labour time previously consumed in reality for the labourer's own benefit would be converted into labour time for the benefit of the capitalist. There would be an alteration not in the length of the working day, but in its division into necessary labour time and surplus labour time. On the other hand, it is evident that the duration of the surplus labour is given, when the length of the working day and the value of labour power are given. The value of labour power, that is, the labour time, requisite to produce labour power, determines the labour time necessary for the reproduction of that value. If one working hour be embodied in sixpence, and the value of a day's labour power be 5 shillings, the labourer must work 10 hours a day in order to replace the value paid by capital for his labour power, or to produce an equivalent for the value of his daily necessary means of subsistence. Given the value of these means of subsistence, the value of his labour power is given, and given the value of his labour power, the duration of his necessary labour time is given. Footnote. The value of his average daily wages is determined by what the labourer requires so as to live, labour and generate. William Petty, Political Anatomy of Ireland, 1672. The price of labour is always constituted of the price of necessaries. Whenever the labouring man's wages will not, suitably to his low rank and station as a labouring man, support such a family as is often the lot of many of them to have, he does not receive proper wages. J. Vanderlint. The mere workman, who has only his arms and his industry, has nothing unless he succeeds in selling his labour to others. In every kind of work it cannot fail to happen, as a matter of fact it does happen, that the wages of the workman are limited to what is necessary to procure him his subsistence. Turgot, Reflexion, etc. The price of necessaries of life is, in fact, the cost of producing labour. Malthus, Inquiry into, etc., Rent, London, 1815. End of footnote. The duration of the surplus labour, however, is arrived at by subtracting the necessary labour time from the total working day. 10 hours subtracted from 12 leave 2, and it is not easy to see how, under the given conditions, the surplus labour can possibly be prolonged beyond 2 hours. No doubt the capitalist can, instead of 5 shillings, pay the labourer 4 shillings and 6pence, or even less. For the reproduction of this value of 4 shillings and 6pence, 9 hours labour time would suffice, and consequently 3 hours of surplus value instead of 2 would accrue to the capitalist, and the surplus value would rise from 1 shilling to 18 pence. This result, however, would be obtained only by lowering the wages of the labourer below the value of his labour power. With the 4 shillings and 6pence which he produces in 9 hours, he commands 1/10 less of the necessaries of life than before, and consequently the proper reproduction of his labour power is crippled. The surplus labour would in this case be prolonged only by an overstepping of its normal limits. Its domain would be extended only by a usurpation of part of the domain of necessary labour time. Despite the important part which this method plays in actual practice, we are excluded from considering it in this place by our assumption that all commodities, including labour power, are bought and sold at their full value. Granted this, it follows that the labour time necessary for the production of labour power or for the reproduction of its value, cannot be lessened by a fall in the labourer's wages below the value of his labour power, but only by a fall in this value itself. Given the length of the working day, the prolongation of the surplus labour must of necessity originate in the curtailment of the necessary labour time. The latter cannot arise from the former. In the example we've taken, it is necessary that the value of labour power should actually fall by 1/10 in order that the necessary labour time may be diminished by 1/10, that is, from 10 hours to 9, and in order that the surplus labour may consequently be prolonged from 2 hours to 3. Such a fall in the value of labour power implies, however, that the same necessaries of life which were formerly produced in 10 hours can now be produced in 9 hours. But this is impossible without an increase in the productiveness of labour. For example, suppose a shoemaker with given tools makes in 1 working day of 12 hours 1 pair of boots. If he must make 2 pairs in the same time, the productiveness of his labour must be doubled. And this cannot be done, except by an alteration in his tools, or in his mode of working, or in both. Hence the conditions of production, that is, his mode of production and the labour process itself, must be revolutionised. By increase in the productiveness of labour, we mean generally an alteration in the labour process of such a kind as to shorten the labour time socially necessary for the production of a commodity, and to endow a given quantity of labour with the power of producing a greater quantity of use value. Footnote. Perfection of the crafts means nothing other than the discovery of new ways of making a product with fewer people, or, which is the same thing, in less time than previously. Sismondi. Etude. End of footnote. Hitherto, in treating of surplus value arising from a simple prolongation of the working day, we have assumed the mode of production to be given and invariable. But when surplus value has to be produced by the conversion of necessary labour into surplus labour, it by no means suffices for capital to take over the labour process in the form under which it has been historically handed down, and then simply to prolong the duration of that process. The technical and social conditions of the process, and consequently the very mode of production, must be revolutionized before the productiveness of labour can be increased. By that means alone can the value of labour power be made to sink, and the portion of the working day necessary for the reproduction of that value be shortened. The surplus value produced by prolongation of the working day I call absolute surplus value. On the other hand, the surplus value arising from the curtailment of the necessary labour time and from the corresponding alteration in the respective lengths of the two components of the working day, I call relative surplus value. In order to effect a fall in the value of labour power, the increase in the productiveness of labour must seize upon those branches of industry whose products determine the value of labour power, and consequently either belong to the class of customary means of subsistence or are capable of supplying the place of those means. But the value of a commodity is determined not only by the quantity of labour which the labourer directly bestows upon that commodity, but also by the labour contained in the means of production. For instance, the value of a pair of boots depends not only on the cobbler's labour, but also on the value of the leather, wax, thread, etc. Hence, a fall in the value of labour power is also brought about by an increase in the productiveness of labour, and by a corresponding cheapening of commodities in those industries which supply the instruments of labour and the raw material that form the material elements of the constant capital required for producing the necessaries of life. But an increase in the productiveness of labour in those branches of industry which supply neither the necessaries of life nor the means of production for such necessaries leaves the value of labour power undisturbed. The cheapened commodity, of course, causes only a pro tanto fall in the value of labour power, a fall proportional to the extent of that commodity's employment in the reproduction of labour power. Shirts, for instance, are a necessary means of subsistence, but are only one out of many. The totality of the necessaries of life consists, however, of various commodities, each the product of a distinct industry, and the value of each of those commodities enters as a component part into the value of labour power. This latter value decreases with the decrease of the labour time necessary for its reproduction, the total decrease being the sum of all the different curtailments of labour time effected in those various and distinct industries. This general result is treated here as if it were the immediate result directly aimed at in each individual case. Whenever an individual capitalist cheapens shirts, for instance, by increasing the productiveness of labour, he by no means necessarily aims at reducing the value of labour power and shortening, pro tanto, the necessary labour time. But it is only in so far as he ultimately contributes to this result that he assists in raising the general rate of surplus value. Footnote. Let us suppose the products of the manufacturer are doubled by improvement in machinery. He will be able to clothe his workmen by means of a smaller proportion of the entire return, and thus his profit will be raised. But in no other way will it be influenced. Ramsay. End of footnote. The general and necessary tendencies of capital must be distinguished from their forms of manifestation. It is not our intention to consider here the way in which the laws immanent in capitalist production manifest themselves in the movements of individual masses of capital, where they assert themselves as coercive laws of competition, and are brought home to the mind and consciousness of the individual capitalist as the directing motives of his operations. But this much is clear. A scientific analysis of competition is not possible before we have a conception of the inner nature of capital. Just as the apparent motions of the heavenly bodies are not intelligible to any but him who is acquainted with their real motions, motions which are not directly perceptible by the senses. Nevertheless, for the better comprehension of the production of relative surplus value, we may add the following remarks, in which we assume nothing more than the results we have already obtained. If 1 hour's labour is embodied in sixpence, a value of 6 shillings will be produced in a working day of 12 hours. Suppose that with the prevailing productiveness of labour, 12 articles are produced in these 12 hours. Let the value of the means of production used up in each article be sixpence. Under these circumstances, each article costs 1 shilling, sixpence for the value of the means of production, and sixpence for the value newly added in working with those means. Now let some one capitalist contrive to double the productiveness of labour, and to produce in the working day of 12 hours 24 instead of 12 such articles. The value of the means of production remaining the same, the value of each article will fall to 9p, made up of 6p for the value of the means of production, and 3p for the value newly added by the labour. Despite the doubled productiveness of labour, the day's labour creates, as before, a new value of 6 shillings and no more, which, however, is now spread over twice as many articles. Of this value, each article now has embodied in it 1/24 instead of 1/12, 3p instead of 6p, or what amounts to the same thing, only 1/2 hour's instead of a whole hour's labour time, is now added to the means of production while they are being transformed into each article. The individual value of these articles is now below their social value. In other words, they have cost less labour time than the great bulk of the same article produced under the average social conditions. Each article costs, on an average, 1 shilling, and represents 2 hours of social labour. But under the altered mode of production, it costs only 9p, or contains only 1.5 hours' labour. The real value of a commodity is, however, not its individual value, but its social value. That is to say, the real value is not measured by the labour time that the article in each individual case costs the producer, but by the labour time socially required for its production. If, therefore, the capitalist who applies the new method sells his commodity at its social value of 1 shilling, he sells it for 3p above its individual value, and thus realises an extra surplus value of 3p. On the other hand, the working day of 12 hours is, as regards him, now represented by 24 articles instead of 12. Hence, in order to get rid of the product of one working day, the demand must be double what it was. That is, the market must become twice as extensive. Other things being equal, his commodities can command a more extended market only by a diminution of their prices. He will therefore sell them above their individual, but under their social value, say at 10p each. By this means, he still squeezes an extra surplus value of 1p out of each. This augmentation of surplus value is pocketed by him, whether his commodities belong or not to the class of necessary means of subsistence that participate in determining the general value of labour power. Hence, independently of this latter circumstance, there is a motive for each individual capitalist to cheapen his commodities by increasing the productiveness of labour. Nevertheless, even in this case, the increased production of surplus value arises from the curtailment of the necessary labour time and from the corresponding prolongation of the surplus labour. Footnote: a man's profit does not depend upon his command of the produce of other men's labour, but upon his command of labour itself. If he can sell his goods at a higher price, while his workmen's wages remain unaltered, he is clearly benefited. A smaller proportion of what he produces is sufficient to put that labour into motion, and a larger proportion consequently remains for himself. Outlines of Political Economy, London, 1832. End of footnote. Let the necessary labour time amount to 10 hours, the value of a day's labour power to 5 shillings, the surplus labour time to 2 hours, and the daily surplus value to 1 shilling. But the capitalist now produces 24 articles, which he sells at 10 pence apiece, making 20 shillings in all. Since the value of the means of production is 12 shillings, 14 2/5 of these articles merely replace the constant capital advanced. The labour of the 12 hours working day is represented by the remaining 9 3/5 articles. Since the price of the labour power is 5 shillings, 6 articles represent the necessary labour time, and 3 3/5 articles the surplus labour. The ratio of the necessary labour to the surplus labour, which under average social conditions was 5 to 1, is now only 5 to 3. The same result may be arrived at in the following way. The value of the product of the working day of 12 hours is 20 shillings. Of this sum, 12 shillings belong to the value of the means of production, a value that merely reappears. There remain 8 shillings, which are the expression in money of the value newly created during the working day. This sum is greater than the sum in which average social labour of the same kind is expressed. 12 hours of the latter labour are expressed by 6 shillings only. The exceptionally productive labour operates as intensified labour. It creates in equal periods of time greater values than average social labour of the same kind. See Chapter 1, Section 2. But our capitalist still continues to pay, as before, only 5 shillings as the value of a day's labour power. Hence, instead of 10 hours, the labourer need now work only 7.5 hours in order to reproduce this value. His surplus labour is, therefore, increased by 2.5 hours, and the surplus value he produces grows from 1 into 3 shillings. Hence, the capitalist who applies the improved method of production appropriates to surplus labour a greater proportion of the working day than the other capitalists in the same trade. He does individually what the whole body of capitalists engaged in producing relative surplus value do collectively. On the other hand, however, this extra surplus value vanishes so soon as the new method of production has become general, and has consequently caused the difference between the individual value of the cheapened commodity and its social value to vanish. The law of the determination of value by labour time, a law which brings under its sway the individual capitalist who applies the new method of production, by compelling him to sell his goods under their social value, this same law, acting as a coercive law of competition, forces his competitors to adopt the new method. Footnote: if my neighbour, by doing much with little labour, can sell cheap, I must contrive to sell as cheap as he, so that every art, trade, or engine, doing work with labour of fewer hands and consequently cheaper, begets in others a kind of necessity and emulation, either of using the same art, trade, or engine, or of inventing something like it, that every man may be upon the square, that no man may be able to undersell his neighbour. The Advantages of the East India Trade to England, London, 1720. End of footnote. The general rate of surplus value is, therefore, ultimately affected by the whole process only when the increase in the productiveness of labour has seized upon those branches of production that are connected with, and has cheapened those commodities that form part of, the necessary means of subsistence, and are therefore elements of the value of labour power. The value of commodities is in inverse ratio to the productiveness of labour. And so too is the value of labour power, because it depends on the values of commodities. Relative surplus value is, on the contrary, directly proportional to that productiveness. It rises with the rising and falls with the falling productiveness. The value of money being assumed to be constant, an average social working day of 12 hours always produces the same new value, 6 shillings, no matter how this sum may be apportioned between the surplus value and wages. But if, in consequence of increased productiveness, the value of the necessaries of life fall, and the value of a day's labour power be thereby reduced from 5 shillings to 3, the surplus value increases from 1 shilling to 3. 10 hours were necessary for the reproduction of the value of the labour power. Now only 6 are required. 4 hours have been set free, and can be annexed to the domain of surplus labour. Hence there is immanent, in capital, an inclination and constant tendency to heighten the productiveness of labour in order to cheapen commodities, and by such cheapening to cheapen the labourer himself. Footnote. In whatever proportion the expenses of a labourer are diminished, in the same proportion will his wages be diminished, if the restraints upon industry are at the same time taken off. Considerations concerning taking off the bounty on corn exported, etc. London, 1753. The interest of trade requires that corn and all provisions should be as cheap as possible, for whatever makes them dear must make labour dear also. In all countries where industry is not restrained, the price of provisions must affect the price of labour. This will always be diminished when the necessaries of life grow cheaper. Wages are decreased in the same proportion as the powers of production increase. Machinery, it is true, cheapens the necessaries of life, but it also cheapens the labourer. A prize essay on the comparative merits of competition and cooperation. London, 1834. End of footnote. The value of a commodity is in itself of no interest to the capitalist. What alone interests him is the surplus value that dwells in it and is realizable by sale. Realization of the surplus value necessarily carries with it the refunding of the value that was advanced. Now, since relative surplus value increases in direct proportion to the development of the productiveness of labour, while on the other hand the value of commodities diminishes in the same proportion, since one and the same process cheapens commodities and augments the surplus value contained in them, we have here the solution of the riddle, why does the capitalist, whose sole concern is the production of exchange value, continually strive to depress the exchange value of commodities? A riddle with which Quesnay, one of the founders of political economy, tormented his opponents, and to which they could give him no answer. You acknowledge, he says, that the more expenses and the cost of labour can, in the manufacture of industrial products, be reduced without injury to production, the more advantageous is such reduction because it diminishes the price of the finished article. And yet, you believe that the production of wealth, which arises from the labour of the workpeople, consists in the augmentation of the exchange value of their products. The shortening of the working day is, therefore, by no means what is aimed at in capitalist production, when labour is economised by increasing its productiveness. Footnote. These speculators, who are so economical of the labour of workers they would have to pay. J. N. Bidault, Paris, 1828. The employer will be always on the stretch to economise time and labour. Dugald Stewart, Works, edited by Sir W. Hamilton, Edinburgh, 1855, Lectures on Political Economy. The capitalist's interest is that the productive powers of the labourers they employ should be the greatest possible. On promoting that power, their attention is fixed, and almost exclusively fixed. R. Jones, end of footnote. It is only the shortening of the labour time necessary for the production of a definite quantity of commodities that is aimed at. The fact that the workman, when the productiveness of his labour has been increased, produces, say, 10 times as many commodities as before, and thus spends 1/10 as much labour time on each, by no means prevents him from continuing to work 12 hours